What do you have in common with an Olympic gold medalist? Turns out, more than you think. Welcome to Loud and Lifted, the Women in Leadership podcast about career growth, confidence, and the real stuff nobody teaches you at work. I'm your host, Betsy Hamm. Today's guest is Charlotte Worthington, an Olympic gold medalist who's represented Great Britain in two Olympics. She's won gold in the women's BMX freestyle park at Tokyo 2020 and became the first woman to land a 360-degree backflip in competition. She also returned to compete at Paris 2024 to defend that title. And even if you've never touched a BMX bike in your life, this conversation is basically Olympic-level leadership training. How to prepare your mind for pressure. How to handle fear without letting it run the show. How expectations can mess with your performance after success. And one of my favorite mindset shifts ever, swap comparison for admiration. Let's get into it. Welcome to Loud and Lifted, Charlotte. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, you know, so you have a history of breaking records and being the first to do things. And, you know, on Loud and Lifted, you are our first Brit guest, number one, and number two, our first Olympic gold medalist. So thanks for, you know, shattering standards over here at Loud and Lifted too. I love that so much.
I love that.
That on your resume.
I will.
So excited to talk to you. You have a really interesting story. And as I said, you're the first to have accomplished a lot of stuff. So you are an Olympic gold medalist in freestyle BMX. And I would love to know how you even got started in this sport.
So I ride BMX freestyle, but I haven't always done that. I got into sort of the extreme sports lifestyle when I was younger through watching my brother. He's older than me and he did skateboarding with his friends and I always thought it was so cool. And we'd see bits of the X Games on like YouTube and things and it was so elusive. It was like a foreign land that just looked amazing. And I always had a hand in it there. And it wasn't until I went on a camping vacation with my family that I saw someone actually riding a stunt scooter first when I was about 12. So same thing on the skate park and you do similar tricks, but maybe it was like a little bit easier, especially as a young girl, like it was a lot easier to throw a little scooter around versus a BMX bike. And I saw someone do tricks and it kind of lit that spark. I just thought it was amazing. And I, like ever since then, I was just sort of addicted to extreme sports. So I did that for quite a while. And it wasn't until I was about 20, like 19, 20 that I decided to pick up a BMX bike, which was just because I'd sort of grown up a little bit and a lot of my friends rode BMX. And I sort of felt like I'd accomplished everything I wanted to on the scooter and I wanted a new challenge, but that was still in that same area of things that I love. And yeah, BMX was a great fit.
That's awesome. So this sounded like it just kind of started something fun to do, right? Like a way to have like a, I guess, activity or sport. But when did this become real? Like, when did this become that you were all in and you wanted to go to the Olympics and make this like your profession?
So that happened really quickly. For reference, I'm 29 now. So I've been riding BMX for 9 years. And when I picked it up, I was working full time in a kitchen as a chef, as a cook. And it was a bit of a turning point of I wasn't riding my bike very much. Like maybe once every 2 weeks because I was working crazy hours. So I sort of wasn't progressing. It was still fun, but it wasn't like something I did as often as I wanted. And I kind of said yes to a couple opportunities because it, like you said, it was just fun and I'm an adventure seeker. And so I went to like this little UK competition and it just happened to be the year that there was this TV show that was scouting for people. So I got scouted for that like a few months later. And whilst I was filming for that, there happened to be the head judge of the UCI there, who's British. And he saw me and said, hey, I don't know if you know, but Team Great Britain is going to be setting up an Olympic team because BMX freestyle is in the Olympics for Tokyo 2020. And this was in like 2017 and I just started. So I kind of thought, well, worst case scenario, I get like, well, basically before then he said, here's a phone number and give it a call and see what they say. So I gave him the call and they offered me to go on the tryouts. So I thought, well, worst case scenario, I'll go on these tryouts, get a week off work and a free trip to North Carolina. And worst case scenario, I go back to work. And best case scenario, I don't. And it happened to be that I get selected. So it was, I'd been riding BMX for like a year. And then this huge opportunity, the series of opportunities, just sort of the stars aligned and sort of land on my lap. And don't get me wrong, I worked hard for them. And I think it was from then that it was like, okay, this is a huge opportunity to just work as hard as I can and maybe, potentially, maybe even make it to the Olympics. Like, it was just a surreal, well, there's a chance here. Like, this is an opportunity. Let's just try and work hard at it and see where it goes. And that was my attitude going into the whole Tokyo process. And it just sort of grew.
Which is amazing because, to your point, you had only just started doing it essentially to, you know, just kind of understanding the sport. And then all of a sudden, like, hey, you keep doing this. Maybe there's an opportunity to go to the Olympics. Like, that's such a cool, cool thought process. So, especially back then, and maybe I'm being stereotypical, but it seems like a very male dominated sport, right? When you say BMX, I think of men doing it. So, when you first got into the sport, especially years ago, like, what barriers did you have to get over, and how was the support around you in this sport for you?
Yeah, I think it was, I think it changed as I grew up. So when I was younger, it felt a little harder, like I was a little bit more outcasted, and teenage boys are sort of interested in teenage girls that, you know, are interested in being teenage girls. And I wasn't interested in that. I was interested in riding scooters at the skate park. So that was a little tough. Sometimes you get compared a lot to other girls that rode scooters or did extreme sports, because there wasn't a lot. There was like a handful in the whole country. And, you know, teenage boys, just they have a different thought process and different attitudes. So at first, like, I didn't think I had my true friends really, but once I sort of grew up and everyone matured, like those sort of late teens, everyone knows a bit more who they are. I found some really awesome friends that I'm still friends with to this day. So that, like, on the whole, everyone was like really supportive. I think, again, once you grow up again and go through that mid-20s shift, you also sort of realize that men and women actually just think differently and have different values. And mainly one of the big things also was like approaches in our world to learning tricks and to fear. For men, stereotypically, their thought process would be that caveman, I have to sort of impress people and out compete and outdo people. And like, it's that thought process. But when I sort of had gone through some struggles and clashes of my own with people trying to convince me to do tricks like that, and it wasn't working, I sort of realized, oh, what actually works for me is more thinking about different values and why I'm doing it and things that are important to me. And it's not about competing and showing up differently. So that was sort of like deciding the two very big differences being in a male dominated sport.
And was part of it, did you have to prove yourself that like you were legit, you were here to compete and to win and you could hang? Like, was that part of the sort of building credibility with them, or was it just over time and age they matured?
Honestly, I think it wasn't even like that. Like, I don't think in that area of sport, it's super competitive like that. I maybe felt like I had to prove myself because I wanted to, and I wanted them to like, yeah, I guess know that I was sort of serious about it, but it didn't mean that I couldn't hang if I didn't want to do that. You know, it's like a very easygoing sport. So I did want to sort of, I think that was a competitiveness in me though, was saying, I want to be able to compete with you boys. Like, I'm not just here to compete against the girls. I want to ride like a boy.
Love that. Love that. So let's talk about the mental toughness. First of all, with your sport, like when I watch some of your videos, I'm like, oh my God, it gives me anxiety to watch it. I know you're going to land it. You were the first woman to land a 360 degree backflip in a competition. Like, I can just visualize that. I can't even fathom how you learned to do something like that. So first, let's talk about the sport. How did you build your confidence and that mental toughness to compete in something that can honestly be incredibly dangerous?
Well, we learn tricks similarly to gymnastics. So there's a foam pit, and then there's what we call a resi ramp, which is like a soft ramp that has a little bit of give versus the solid wood. So there's a little bit of a step-by-step process. And I think
that doesn't make it sound any better, just for the record.
Well, you'll do things in the foam pit, get it really dialed and confident before you're ready to commit on the resi. But it is a big jump, like it's a big step. And it's always a mental thing whenever you level up a trick. You're going from the foam pit where the level of risk is very low to the resi where it's suddenly becomes much higher. And it's always a mental challenge to say, I just need to do the exact same thing that I'm doing in the foam pit to what I'm doing on the resi ramp. And often the fear, it always happens, like the fear will make you hold back a little bit. You might lean back without realizing, you might rush it because you're like, I just want to get it over with, or whatever it is. So there's definitely that practice of mental toughness there for sure.
So how do you do that? How do you improve your mental toughness? You know, one of our most talked about topics on this podcast has been about confidence and getting outside your comfort zone. And you are doing that mentally, physically. So how, I'm sure you had ups and downs. So how do you deal with that and kind of build that? It becomes easier.
Yeah, definitely. And it's honestly just practice. I think people don't realize you can practice these things, like preparing for a high pressure situation or a dangerous situation. Like, you can practice your thought process, and that's through different techniques such as breathing. Like, it's whatever works for you personally, but there's things out there like breathing, returning to your breath and getting really present. There's visualization, like that's a big one for us. It's visualizing not only like what's going to happen, but also probably what feelings and thoughts you are predicting will come to your brain, because that's actually out of your control, but it is in your control how you respond to that. So you can think, okay, I'm going to go into this big competition, or I'm going to go into this meeting boardroom, and I'm probably going to feel at some point like I don't deserve to be there, or like everyone's really intimidating, or I'm going to overthink everything that I do or say. And it's like that. It's not necessarily true. That's a lot of just random thoughts that anxiety and things is just bringing. So if you can visualize and predict those things are going to come, it's like you hear it. The key is hearing it and saying, okay, I kind of thought that I was going to think this in this situation. How did I plan to respond? What was it? Was it like, I need to just take a deep breath? Or was it, I need to argue with that thought and say, nope, that's not true. This is what's true, is that I'm here to do the thing. So it's definitely like practice, and taking a really objective sort of attitude into that helps as well, because the emotions can, they definitely cloud and fog things up a little bit. And it's not to say don't dismiss your emotions, but sure, it's definitely to say like, be aware of things that are emotions and might not necessarily be true. So practice is a big one for both doing a trick every day, physically and mentally, and going into those high pressure situations.
Yeah. So let's talk about high pressure situations. I mean, the Olympics is the highest pressure situation when you're an athlete, and just the pressure I'm sure that you feel, that you put on yourself, you're representing your company. So when you were at the Olympics, how did you, I mean, obviously the preparation, the practice that went into prior before you went to Olympics, but you know, how did you get through that super exciting, where you probably wanted to like love every moment and the fact that you were there, but balancing that with the pressure that you just felt during that?
Well, I've had two Olympic experiences. I've had the absolute best, perfect Olympic experience, and I've had the absolute worst Olympic experience out in Paris. The best one came first, which is awesome. And how I prepared for the best one was a lot of visualization, like I said. At that time, I was working a lot on my self-belief and being able to sort of fight those negative thoughts. And I'd faced a lot of injuries too. I'd dislocated my shoulder even 6 weeks before that Olympics. So it was actually a blessing in disguise, because it made me focus on the things I needed to focus on. So that was seeing like a big opportunity in that. So visualization was massive, a lot of things physically. And I remember that day, I was often returning to my breathing. I was returning to keeping that right perspective. And I think I went into it sort of a certain amount of non-attachment to the result. I was fully prepared to walk away with absolutely nothing, because for me, like, the bar was like, I'm at the Olympics. Like, I didn't even think I would get here. So it really doesn't matter if I walk away with nothing. I just didn't see the downside, really. And I think it was being able to be just totally present in the process through all those things, visualization, breathing techniques and practice, that allowed me to sort of not be thinking about the result and just say it's out of my control, because so much, especially in our sport, is out of your control. And it was that that allowed me to take the risk and be calm and present and just be like, if I mess up, what does it really change? Like, I'm still going to enjoy riding my bike and I'll just be back where I was with, like, before. It doesn't make a big difference. Like, I think that was just so healthy. And then I've made the mistake of going into the next Olympics without realizing sort of everything had flipped upside down. And I suddenly was going in with this massive expectation of like feeling a need and a pressure to get gold and like working backwards and just assuming that that was now the bar that was set. And I should have, in hindsight, like it's a much better approach to sort of start with a blank slate and not have any of those expectations, because you don't know what's going to come up along the journey. And it's not sustainable also to be riding at that high level for such a long time. You need the peaks and the troughs, and you need to be okay and confident in accepting them.
That's so interesting. And that's so true just in life generally, where, you know, you went in with this sort of open mind and, hey, look what I've accomplished to this point the first time, and it worked out well. And then the second time, just the pressure and the stress that you're putting on yourself just impacted your performance and impacted your experience, which, you know, I think we can all relate to. So that's super interesting thought process for sure. You know, one thing you had talked about when I heard you speak on a panel, what I never really thought about is the difference in participating in an individual sport versus a team sport, right? Like, I grew up playing team sports. My daughters play volleyball. So everything's team, 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 and the camaraderie and lifting each other up. So when you're in an individual sport, how does that work, right? Like, who's there to support you? Who's there to, you know, be your cheerleader physically, mentally, emotionally, whatever it is? But how does that work? And how do you manage to have that strength to be on your own?
Well, I think it's a little bit of a personal preference as to whether you like team sports or individual sports. As a teenager, I always hated team sports. And I think it was because I probably had a couple negative experiences, and I felt like, I think just my thought process was, when I mess up, I let other people down, versus if I just mess up on my own, then I let myself down and it's fine. Like, I could deal with that more than letting other people down at the time. I think that was my thought process.
Interesting.
And I also liked being able to do stuff on my own a little bit. Like, I'm fine being a bit of a loner at times. BMX is very collaborative, but I am okay doing my sport like in my own space and world. Like, it's where I get to escape, and that's why I loved it so much. So when you compete in that, again, two very different experiences, and the sport also has just developed with the implication of the Olympics. So like at the start, the first Olympic cycle for those first 3 years, I was pretty much the only girl, or at least the only girl that was that dedicated the whole time. There was like other girls on the team, but they didn't last the whole way. And I was sort of guilty in being a bit like, that's sort of my comfort zone. Like, I was fine with that. And again, it was an individual sport. I was happy being out there on my own. I was single, sort of, I was very much just a lone wolf. And I think it was post Tokyo, a lot shifted. Like, I got married recently. I was engaged a couple of years ago when I met my husband, Matt. I suddenly had this team around me, like two teams. I had a support team with my friends and family. And I also had this team now with the BMX. And it was actually like a bit of a struggle to adjust to that, because my comfort zone is sort of being that lone wolf. But then it was an adjustment of, well, this team thing is sort of being forced upon me because the popularity of the sport and the investment of the sport is going up, and I'm being told to like be a role model and do all this stuff and help people, which I love doing all that. But I just sort of, I had a lot on my shoulders, and I didn't know how to handle suddenly becoming the Olympic champion and then having all these moving parts of different people in what I had my process figured out, and it was all changing, and I wasn't doing well with like the change with that, honestly. And I've learned a lot since then about team sports, and how now I have changed my perspective on, if I'm in a team, helping others often helps me. And it's a little tough in an individual sport. You have to really drop your ego, because in one sense, it can feel like if I help others, then I'm not helping myself, because they're getting better, therefore that increases the gap for me, and therefore I'm getting worse. And like, I was really stuck in that thought process for a long time. And I was kind of battling myself as like, I want to be a good, helpful person, and I know I can help these people, but like, I almost feel awful about doing it, or like it's stressing me out doing it because it's like making my job harder. And I was in a bit of a tough loop. So that's definitely some lessons I've learned about teamwork, like painful lessons. And now I embrace it a lot more. And I feel like an individual sport, whilst you're out there competing against everyone, at the same time, you're competing against no one because everyone's out there competing against everyone. So I kind of like that, and it's a good perspective. And now I'll embrace team and feeling like I've got that home support, and life isn't like all about me, and it's an individual sport. Sport itself is very selfish, and it's actually now it's healthier for me to have those distractions. So it's like changed my perspective a lot of learning.
Absolutely. And you legit are competing against these people, right? Like, we talk about from a professional situation where women feel like they're competing for a role, or, and maybe they're not, maybe it's just for attention or status or whatever it is, where we create this competition in our head. But here you are in a situation where you really are competing. Like, somebody could take your spot or get it in the next Olympics or the next event, which is interesting to your point of trying to balance that, that they can push you, but then they could also take your spot. So especially as, you know, as more women probably were getting involved in the sport, how did you deal with that specifically with women, with the ego and the competition piece? And again, you are competing, so it does make it interesting. So how did you start to embrace that, deal with it, and as you continue to grow?
You say, like, if you help someone else in a team, your team gets better, and therefore you get better. But if you help someone else individually, it sometimes doesn't feel like that. So I sort of worked a lot on, it was a tough time, and I had to take a bit of a break and sort of distance myself from it all, because I was just very wrapped up in these negative thought cycles. So I did that and took a long, long, hard look at myself. And I read a couple books that also helped a lot. One was Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday. And as someone who was always much more underconfident growing up and felt a bit left out and bullied and whatever, and I always thought, I'm not egotistical. Like, ego is being, I'm the best and I'm all arrogant and you should, like, you know, think I'm better than everyone. That's what I thought ego was. And the start of this book just quotes, ego is simply either, I think I'm better than everyone, so you should treat me differently, or it's, I think I'm worse than everyone, so you should treat me differently. And it took a minute for me to handle, like, how can being underconfident be egotistical? And then I would sort of see the impact of sort of people being all down on themselves, the impact it has on the rest of the room, and not being supportive of other people. It really does, it sucks the energy out of the room, and it's kind of selfish, and it's being a bit, instead of like dropping your own struggles that you have right now and saying, you know what, it's not my day, but it's your day, and let's make your day the best day. And through doing that, it's going to make me feel inspired and better about myself. So that was like definitely quite a big journey. I was evaluating, like, where am I getting upset over someone that's doing something that's out of my control? It's affecting me so much. So it was definitely a personal deep dive of ego. And I eventually came up with a quote that just helped me get through it, which was swap comparison for admiration. Mm. Instead of just saying, stop doing this or don't do that, your brain needs an action to focus on. So I was like, okay, every time I see like my competition do something in the skate park, I'm going to tell my brain to stop comparing and then give it something to focus on and say, admire it. So look at this trick in my case that my competition's doing and say, wow, that's so good. Like, yeah, I can't do that, but I hope I can. Like, I hope I can learn that. Or what's she doing that I can learn from that? Or how can I interpret that in my own riding? And that really helped me like put an action in there to help get over my sort of competitiveness with other women, because it was like a real struggle when you're used to being the only girl in a male-dominated environment, and there's only a couple of you, it's a lot easier to be compared against each other and compare yourselves against each other. And I think that's where a lot of women just don't remember to, that it's hard to like let go of yourself and just support others. But I think other people have done it for me, and it was so powerful. And I thought, wow, like, you don't have to say something nice because I'm competing against you, and that's made me feel real good. Like, I really admire that, and that's really strong. And I think, and I've definitely heard like strong women support strong women. So strong women support other women, sorry. So it really made me think, wow, it is strong to like be confident in yourself, and you just know yourself enough to be able to support someone else and not be beaten down by it. So yeah, I swapped comparison for admiration, and it definitely helped change my perspective on that. And now when I see things that in the past would have triggered me to like shrink and feel bad about myself, it makes me open up and go, what can I learn from that? That's awesome. Give her praise and like just admire it and say, I want to do that, or what can I do to contribute to that? And it's because I don't think I would think that way about seeing a boy do a trick like that. I would just think, oh, they're just doing that trick and that's cool. But if it was a girl, it's like a big deal. It's like, oh, she's doing that, but I'm not doing that. And it means all this stuff. And it's like, drop all the meaning and drop your ego with it.
I love that. I love swap comparison for admiration. That's such a great line. And I think what's super interesting that people don't realize, whether it's in sports or professionally, sometimes we think that, oh, you get to a certain level, you win a gold medal, you're a VP at work, whatever it is, that suddenly you're confident and you're not comparing yourself to other, and you're not going to be jealous or whatever it is. And the reality is that's just kind of like in us. So it doesn't matter to a lot of us, like what you have accomplished, you're still looking around and it's taking that as a positive, right? Like not making it a jealous behavior or, you know, talking shit about somebody, whatever it is. But to your point, taking that as a positive and being like, oh, that's great. That's awesome. Because I think we just sometimes get in our head that we'll get to a certain level and then everything will be fine. But the reality is we've got to quiet that voice or flip that script.
I think you get to a certain level and it actually makes it tenfold harder, because then you just have this expectation of, well, now I'm the Olympic gold medalist, so I have to be the best in the room. Every time I enter the room, I have to be the best in the room. And like, that was kind of that mentality that I thought at the time was helpful and it was pushing me, and it kind of was short term. But it can only go so far, and it's not sustainable, and it's not very enjoyable. So I definitely felt like I lost myself when I started focusing on meeting those expectations, and I wasn't adapting to change, and I wasn't letting my ego go and being willing to look at things differently.
That makes sense.
That was, yeah, when I was up against it most.
True. And you feel the pressure that you're obviously putting on yourself, but then you feel like everybody else has their eyes on you, pressure on you, like, oh, what is she doing? How does she do that? Because they're looking up to you, and hopefully it's an admiration. Like, I want to be like Charlotte, like, look what she's accomplished. Are you considered old for your sport yet? Like, are you one of the trailblazers, right? So, you know, looking up to the older women who are in the sport, I'm sure you're like this icon. So it's hard to be that icon status, I'm sure, and not have too much pressure on yourself. So that I can see how that happens, but it seems like you've taken the right approach to deal with that. And I'm sure it's a daily, monthly, whatever thing that you have to deal with. And I think a lot of times we get stuck like, oh, I talked about it in my head, I thought about it and move on. But this is probably a constant struggle that you have to stay focused on and make sure you're being positive about it.
Yeah, it's definitely it's a daily practice, you know. And I wouldn't even refer to it as like a struggle. I think it's just like a perspective and a practice. Like you've never arrived. Like I think the moment you think you've arrived in knowing how life works and you've got all your hacks and things, I think that's when life will slap you in the face and say, no,
totally fair.
Yeah. It's because that's happened to me. And I think it's definitely like a constant practice, and don't get me wrong, I'm not perfect at it. I veer away from it every now and then, and I need reminding. And that's why we call it practice. Like it's not perfect. I think if you're living from that practice and that idea, then on the whole, it just sort of makes your life a lot better and you get a lot better at it. So
absolutely. So I think now you have the opportunity to be working with young athletes. So when you are working with them at these camps, what kind of, you know, mentality or mental toughness are you trying to help not instill in them, but just be a good role model about?
I think probably that number one thing is the comparison, especially with like the Olympics being such a big part of our sport now. You see a lot of kids starting it because they have seen the Olympics, which is amazing. And they say, I'm so inspired by the Olympics, I want to do that. But then they feel like they have to be the best in the room. They feel like they have to be better than their friends. And I've seen the Olympics change the culture a lot in the youth. And it's gone from this much more relaxed sport where no one's competing against anyone to then now there's a lot more comparison and there's a lot more everyone's competing against everyone for the Olympic spot. And it's actually like such a long journey, and a lot can change in a year, in 3 months, in a week. Like, so it's just really about staying in your own lane. It's freestyle because you're supposed to do it freely and there's no rules on what tricks you're supposed to do. So I would just really encourage the young people today to like stay in their own lane, be supportive and encouraging of others, because it will make you better and they will do it in return, which is going to make you better ultimately. And yeah, just like focus on enjoying it, because that's where you'll find your spark and what lights you up and what keeps you going. Because if you can't find that or you lose that, it's a very unforgiving sport if you're not enjoying it. So, and I think that probably goes for any sport, the amount of dedication and grueling hours it takes. You've got to find a good balance of, I'm doing this sport and it's something I do, but it's not all that I do. And it's just something that I enjoy.
Love that. So what's next for you?
Not massively sure. I've just taken 2025 as like a year off. I set no goals other than very small, quiet goals. And I just wanted to like see where it took me, because I've lived this structured Olympic life for like 7 or 8 years now for 2 Olympic cycles. And I definitely felt like I'd sort of lost my intuition a little bit as to like where I really wanted to be and following my heart, and it didn't feel as exciting anymore. So I stripped away all the competition. I stripped away all the structure. I'm blessed enough to be able to take a year out, like very lucky to be in that position. I felt like I found myself a lot again, and I was waiting for the answers to come within me as to what I want to do. So looking towards 2026, I do want to return to competition later this year. As far as setting LA as the next goal, I'm really not sure yet. I'm going to see how it goes. And I don't mean the results. I just mean emotionally, like if I go to the event and I really enjoy it, or if I'm like, this is what I thought it was or isn't what I thought it was. And we'll just see. Right. So trying to take the same sort of approach as Tokyo, being really open-minded. But I also want to have some side projects. Like I want to help things in the community in State College, where I recently moved to, get into a bit of public speaking. I hosted a young women's event last year that was like a huge success, where again, I got the girls to they competed against each other, but they also had to work as teams. It was BMX based. So again, trying to pass on the learnings that I've got now, and I did it because I want to help the culture of BMX versus the Olympics progress of BMX, you know, because right. The culture is like what makes it special.
Oh, and that would have such a lasting impression. I love that you're doing that, of course, especially with young girls and in that sport. So that's awesome. So I love that approach. Well, Charlotte, if people want to connect with you, where can they find you?
I'm mostly on Instagram, which is, my handle is at Chazwerther, Chazwerther.
Awesome. Great. We'll put that in the show notes too. Thank you so much for being here. You have an awesome story, and I know you're just getting started, so I can't wait to see what you do next. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Betsy.
All right, Charlotte, she's the real deal. My biggest takeaway, pressure is trainable. You can rehearse the thoughts you know are coming. Stay present in the process and stop letting the outcome hijack your performance. In that reframe, swap comparison for admiration, it isn't just a nice quote. It's a practice that changes how you show up around other high-performing women. If this episode helps you, please subscribe or follow below. Thanks for listening. Stay loud, stay lifted, and practice your admiration.